Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, August 3rd, 2013. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. Today we're going to be discussing what the global financial oligarchy has planned for the entire United States if we don't stop them by restoring Glass-Steagall banking legislation. This new model is being imposed by the financial oligarchy as what can only be described as a fascist banker's dictatorship, with the city of Detroit as a test case. If we cannot defeat what they are already imposing on Detroit, this model will be imposed on all cities, counties, and states in the nation. Placing Detroit under a Chapter 9 bankruptcy, which was done by an unelected so-called emergency financial manager, was not done to save or help the people of Detroit. I think that's an important point we have to make, just as the International Monetary Fund policies for Greece, Spain, Portugal, and Italy have done nothing to help the people of those countries, but to keep an orderly flow of funds into the banks and financial institutions, while cutting back the programs that are necessary to keep people alive. The same thing is being done to Detroit right now, to save the worthless debt obligations that were forced on Detroit by Wall Street and the City of London bankers in the first place. The unilateral decision by Kevin Orr, who is the emergency manager, to pay off derivative debts to the banks while drastically reducing, or should I say stealing, the pension obligations to retired municipal employees violates the Michigan Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, and it violates the sense of justice and fairness that's held by most Americans. The question is, will they get away with this? Given that we do have a commitment to justice and fairness in this country, will the people be activated in time to save the people and not the banks? Joining me today to discuss this will be two very active people from Detroit, both of whom were in Washington over the last couple of weeks to get out the real story of how the rape of Detroit is about to become the rape of the United States. Lamar Lemons III is a former state legislator who served, I believe, in the Michigan House or Senate. I will find out from him in a minute, from 1999 to 2007, and he is currently the president of the Detroit Board of Education. Lamar, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us today is Bill Roberts, a former congressional candidate in Michigan who received 41% of the vote in the 2012 Democratic primary. And Bill is also a member of the LaRouche PAC Policy Committee. Bill, let me also welcome you to the LaRouche Show.
Good afternoon, Harley.
Bill, let's start with you, and then we'll bring in Lamar in a minute or two. I want to just set the stage by discussing what's just been done to Detroit. What does it mean that the city's been declared bankrupt, and what is the so-called remedy that the bankers have for Detroit?
Well, I'll just start off by pointing out that Detroit's been under a financial dictatorship since earlier this year. And that's exactly what this is. And it is the emergency manager, so-called, who has filed Chapter 11 bankruptcy supposedly for the city of Detroit. But as you mentioned, this isn't some honest attempt to turn the finances of the city around, but it's actually an additional step being taken on behalf of Wall Street to further loot the city of Detroit and accelerate the death rate. Because what's been done is that there is a petition for a federal bankruptcy process where the banks that hold interest swap agreements with the city of Detroit, such as UBS and Bank of America, are being bailed out. They're being guaranteed 70 to 80 cents on the dollar for essentially exit fees. This is really part of the arrangement. But the pensioners are going to be told in this process that their pensions aren't there. which is a violation of the Michigan Constitution. Now, the point that I was making in meetings with the Congress in the last 3 weeks, and Lamar was as well, is that this is a test case for the nation, that Congress has got to fulfill their commitment to the Constitution by bankrupting Wall Street, not Detroit. That these institutions that are making these demands will move on from Detroit to inflict the same suffering on the rest of the population. And in fact, this is a mirror of what the 2010 Dodd-Frank bill sets up in Title II, which is what's known as the bail-in policy. Screw the population, guaranteed bailouts for the banks by allowing them to rip off their depositors, just as we saw in Cyprus earlier this year. So the only way that this can be dealt with, Wall Street has got to be bankrupted, and that is the intention of Glass-Steagall. Glass-Steagall is not a legislative action that's intended to stabilize the markets or anything like that. The intention here is to shut down the criminals who have used this Glass-Steagall-free environment to carry out the largest criminal operations ever seen in the United States, through collapsing the food supply, through rigging the commodities markets, and using this advantage they have without Glass-Steagall, where commercial banks can also do private investment operations and speculate on the markets with the type of federal guarantees that only commercial banks had before with Glass-Steagall. And this has to be shut down. Glass-Steagall will do that, but it will also put these institutions that are swimming in their own toxic debts, it will force them those debts to be reconciled, which will put them through a bankruptcy process. That's the only way to save the American population and to actually put the nation back on the course of a real economy using the credit methods of Alexander Hamilton. So that was the message we brought to Congress this week, this past couple of weeks.
As we'll get into in the program, the debt was built up with loans from these banks who charged underwriting fees and then demanded that there be insurance on these loans on interest rates, which is what the interest rate swaps are all about. And we'll get into that in a moment. Bill, just very quickly, the emergency financial manager, this Kevin Orr, he was not elected to the position. How did he end up in charge of Detroit?
He was appointed, and Lamar can say more about this because I know he's very familiar with it, but he was appointed by the governor of Michigan, who moved before the implementation of a referendum vote statewide, which actually determined that emergency financial managers are illegal. So he moved before the implementation of that, I believe, to say that supposedly Detroit cannot handle its own debts, and therefore there has to be this unelected banker's dictator put in place to make all decisions, financial decisions, in the same way that this has been done in Greece to disastrous effects.
So there's an election coming up in Detroit, I believe, to choose a mayor and a city council. They really are pretty much powerless then.
That's right.
And Lamar, I asked you before the program, you are the president of the school board of education in Detroit, but with this emergency financial manager, it doesn't seem as though elections matter anymore.
That's correct. Let me first of all say it, it's Chapter 9, not Chapter 11. But also what occurred was through a series of legislation. There was always on the book, well, since 1990, what was called Public Act 72 of 1990. And that allowed for an emergency financial manager who would be only over the finances of a school district or a municipality. And that is key because they were limited in their scope. And the emergency financial managers, particularly those over the school districts, didn't like the limitations that were that they were put under Public Act 72 of 1990, and so they lobbied and had a more comprehensive power, giving them total power, quite frankly, under Public Act 4. So they weren't just over the finances, they were over all of the city operations. Before, they were only in positions to say you were the emergency financial manager could only say you could only spend this or you don't have the money for that. And so they were very limited. They went for Public Act 4. The legislature passed under Snyder, Governor Snyder passed Public Act 4 of 2011, I believe, or 2010, which gave them power, total power. They had gave them the power of both council and the mayor's office, and in the case of the school board, school districts, they gave them the power of both the superintendent and the school board, all the school board members, and totally eliminated democracy. What is also very important, and it's why you know it's a fascist entity, not only is this small oligarchy dictating, but you also have the emergency manager is also responsible for appointing the police chief, which is different than the emergency financial manager, who could only say what the police chief would be paid, to let you know the distinction. So under the Public Act 72, the emergency financial manager could say the police chief could only be paid X, Y, could be paid $100,000 and not $150,000 as the city council and mayor wanted. Well, under Public Act, under Public Act 4, he could dictate who the police chief was. And that's not just for the police chief. That's just an example. That's for all offices. But I chose the police chief because when the people don't have direct control through their mayor over the police department, then you know for sure you're under a fascist state. If you had any illusions that democracy still remained, when you don't control because police officers become an army of occupation. So we have a police chief that the voters, through their mayor and council, did not appoint.
Well, that's also an important. That's important because if you look at what happened in Greece, the European Union cut funding to the Greek government in almost every area, except for tear gas and riot control equipment. They had plenty of money for that, and I think what you're pointing to is that they have the same kind of approach with the control of the police chief. Go ahead.
They gave the police chief as a matter of fact, the police chief got a raise. In fact, he makes more than a mayor. The police chief makes about $250,000 a year now, as opposed to $125,000 under the elected governance. And now, and the mayor only makes $150,000, $160,000 in the city of Detroit. So you can see the importance. They know the importance of having control of the military. You see the same thing in Egypt and other places. Control of the military trumps anything else. So because if you can, because that's the unit that will enforce their dictates.
Well, let me ask you then, I'd like to get a picture for our listeners of what the situation is on the ground in Detroit, how the recent period has seen a decline in living standards, in police and fire protection, in the schools. What is it like in Detroit now under the decline economically of the last 15, 20 years?
Well, exactly. There's been a steady decline when there was the banks withdrew all the money from Detroit. We'll start there. And they allowed they began to foreclose even before the housing collapse to foreclose on the homes and leave these abandoned and not secure those homes, not maintain those homes. So those homes were vandalized and plundered and the copper were removed and they left empty halls throughout the city. These abandoned halls are blighted throughout the city of Detroit to the point of probably 200,000 of these structures, either homes or businesses and buildings, when they could have just reduced their rates and the interest rates. And of course, it was the total, the perfect storm when the real estate market collapsed due to the sale of the bundling and the derivatives. And so that accelerated what was already going on in the city of Detroit, because the factories had closed down and there was no industry to come in and replace it. And you had mass unemployment and mass desertion. We went from almost 2 million people down to 700,000. Many of those 700,000 are elderly. I would say at least 70% are over the age of 50. So, and there has been a removal of city services. We have the street lights out. At least 50% of the street lights are out, and some of them just need a bulb to be changed. But they've laid off all the people who changed the bulbs. emergency medical service in the city of Detroit is abysmal, and you have no one to take you to the hospital. Sometimes there are only two or three trucks running in the entire city of 140 square miles. And you could put three of the comparable populated cities within the city of Detroit. You can put Frisco and Boston and some other city could fit within the geographical boundaries of the city of Detroit. You have crime, of course. When you have street lights out, mass unemployment, I don't have to tell you what the crime situation is. So you routinely hear. The bandits with AK-47s, so they can outgun the police.
Now, one thing you mentioned, Lamar, that caught my attention, that the population, there's a shift demographically to largely an elder or older population. These are the people who are going to be hit by the theft of the pension funds, aren't they?
Exactly. Their pension funds, and also the state cut the taxes on the wealthy, and we had a prohibition on taxing the pensions. And the Snyder, one of his first and earlier acts was to enact a pension on public pensioners. So now that people the reduced pension has already been reduced, and now for the first time it is taxed. So people are moving. Some of the elderly are moving out of the Michigan, so they don't get hit with this humongous pension tax. And now they're going to cut the pensions for a lot of the pension from City of Detroit pensioners. And so now they're bringing these austere measures on the elderly, those who have already retired, those who have no ability to re-enter the workplace and try to earn income.
And those who already paid into the system, because the pension fund comes out of your regular paycheck. You put into the pension fund, and that's
exactly being sold. Or you negotiate that pay. So that was your pay. And so they're really taking from you what you've already earned.
And let me just ask you about the schools, because I know there have been a lot of school closings, teacher layoffs, and you're with the Board of Education. What is the situation facing young people in Detroit?
Well, what they've done in Detroit is they've tried to they're systematically dismantling the school system in favor of this charter movement, where they allow these mostly Republican-led charter entities to come in and profit from the children while not providing any decent education. And so they become profit-making entities, and these are mostly Republicans who are the operators of these entities.
And what does that mean for the public school system?
And it has caused the public school system is down from a peak of 300,000 down to 50,000 and steadily declining. And you have another 70,000 children within the city of Detroit that either are bust themselves to the suburbs or are run by these ineffective charter institutions. Also, the state created another entity called the Educational Achievement Authority, and they took away five of the high schools and 10 of the K-8 schools and placed them in this authority and take those revenues because they're trying to dismantle the Detroit public school system while simultaneously leaving the taxpayers on the hook to pay for the buildings that are being operated. And they leased the building to these private entities for $1. And not just the building, but everything in it, the books, the supplies, the smart boards, the computers, et cetera, $1 a year.
Wow. Well, you're listening to Lamar Lemons III from Detroit, the president of the school board. And we're also talking with Bill Roberts. This is the LaRouche Show for Saturday, August 3rd, 2013. And we're going to continue the discussion. Bill, as you've just heard Lamar talk about this, one of the lines that's put out from Wall Street and from a lot of Republicans, but also you hear it from the Wall Street Democrats, is that the problem with Detroit is unions, mismanagement, pensions that are paid that are too high. It really angers me when I hear some Wall Street banker who gets a $10 million bonus saying whose bank got hundreds of billions in bailout funds complaining about $20,000 a year pensions for retired teachers. How did Detroit get into the situation, Bill? It's obviously the last couple of years with the post-2008 blowout of the housing bubble. There was the auto crisis before that, but this has been a much longer process, hasn't it?
Yeah, this process didn't start under President George W. Bush or Obama, but it has been accelerated. I mean, look, the destruction of the machine tool and automaking capability, the machine tool design capability, the auto parts production, and the auto manufacturing capability as a source of generating wealth within the entire region of Detroit has been increasingly gutted. And this did happen under the shift to globalization, an economy that was supposed to be driven by financial services. The manufacturing capability was taken out of Michigan, put overseas, or just shut down in some cases. This came to a real point of conflict or confrontation around the proposal that Mr. Lyndon LaRouche made in 2005 to revive this manufacturing capability, not necessarily to try to get back the number of cars that were being manufactured, but actually to have a federal authority under which unused plant floor space and people would be employed and using this retooled capacity, much in the type of way that this was done in World War II, to build not cars but or machine guns or tanks, as was done during the war, but to build domestic infrastructure, maglev trains, nuclear power. This was rejected by the Congress and by the President George Bush at the time. And this led to not only a decrease in the number of people employed in the auto industry, but the people who were hired after many auto workers took a bailout and left their jobs, the people who were employed, the only people who were employed at that point, in some cases younger people, were being paid half the wages. And so there's this labor recycling process. Also, in 2002, Detroit saw the peak of property values, of revenue sharing. from revenues being shared from large heavy industry institutions and things like that. So this collapse in revenue and the collapse in the ability to generate wealth through heavy manufacturing intersected the the repeal of Glass-Steagall, the liberalization of the banking system in 1999. And what the takedown of Glass-Steagall did was it actually allowed Wall Street to come in as a sort of predatory lender, much in the same way that this was done in the housing sector, to lure unemployed people who otherwise couldn't get houses, home mortgages, to get into predatory loans in which they were tricked into financial agreements that they really didn't, in some cases, understand. Well, this has happened to cities, too. At a certain point, there was a series of financial swaps agreements that were worked out, which were basically rigged at the highest level with the complicity of people like Timothy Geithner, who was the New York Fed chief at the time. And cities like Detroit and others, like Philadelphia and Houston, were literally bilked out of hundreds of millions of dollars. And so this collapsed state of the economy was used to literally lure the cities into a series of predatory loans, which looted the city further. And then in that condition of more and more of what little was left of the revenue base going to now pay these rigged financial agreements, the police stations were shut down, fire stations were shut down, which actually has accelerated the rate of death of citizens. The response time of police has gone. So there's been a very deliberate process, and you can ask yourself the question, did this just happen? Was this something that just came about through a series of misfortunes or corrupt elected officials? Of course not. There is an intention. And Detroit came under attack specifically because Detroit was really the center of the productive machine of the nation. And it came under attack specifically for that reason by the enemies of this nation on Wall Street and in London. You know, an attack directly on the American system of political economy.
Well, Bill, on that point, you could argue very conclusively that Detroit's emergence as a city, its wealth came from skilled, productive workers who were capable of constant innovation in the machine tool sector. Now that that's being destroyed, how can they say that this austerity will lead to a recovery? Where's the wealth going to come from?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Now, just on this other question, to make it clear to our listeners what we're talking about, Orr's agreement, the deal he made with the swap dealers, the people who sold this fraudulent insurance, that there was a condition you had to buy insurance to get the loan, and the insurance was supposedly to protect against swings of interest rates. But the same banks that made the loans and sold the insurance were rigging the interest rates. As a result of that, they're getting from Orr an agreement for $225 million in payoffs, whereas the pensions are going to be cut. And I understand, Lamar, that Congressman Conyers is planning a hearing on this. When you were in Washington, do you have a sense that any of the congressmen are up in arms on this? I know John Conyers is, but what's the mood among the Michigan congressional delegation, including the two senators who are both Democrats?
Okay, I did meet with the Stabenow people, and we did also meet with the Levin. Mm-hmm. And Levin, neither made any commitment beyond Dodd-Frank, they made no commitment beyond that. Gary Peters, who is actually my congressperson, who's also a candidate for
he's going to run for Levin's seat, right?
He's running, right, he's a candidate for the U.S. Senate for the the seat to be vacated by Levin also has been made, and he's on the Finance Committee. So we did, and we will continue to lobby Congressman Peters on that on this issue. And as we did ask him to support House Resolution H.R. 129, sponsored from a representative, and I can't think of her name.
Marcy Kaptur. That's the Glass-Steagall bill in the House.
The Glass-Steagall bill. So we did lobby for the Glass-Steagall bill and to stop investment, the intermingling between investment and commercial banking, which is what we still have here in the and what Kevin Orr is negotiating. You remember, Kevin Orr is a bankruptcy attorney, and he has a conflict because he's also the emergency manager, and his firm was awarded the contract. So there's no really check balance and oversight. So he has the ability to manipulate this process. And Kevin Orr is an unelected dictator because he's not simply over the finances. He's over everything, every commission, every board, the water department. And he has total authority to jettison any of these institutions, museums, everything.
Lamar, let me ask you a question, because this is something that I did get a couple of questions from people, and someone wanted to know your thoughts on the following. You look at what Senator Levin did in hearings right after the 2008 crash with Coburn, the senator from Oklahoma, where they said there was significant evidence of corruption and fraud committed by the banks, both on the mortgage side of things and then also on derivatives and so on. And they actually called for criminal prosecution, which was never done because the Obama administration and Geithner and Eric Holder have refused to prosecute the bankers and instead have given them a free hand with Dodd-Frank. Now, what's your thought? I mean, LaRouche said last night very sharply that this is corruption and cowardice by the Congress to not take this on. You've been in the fight. You've been in politics. You've seen this up close. What holds someone like Senator Levin back? Why doesn't he follow through in ensuring prosecution instead of just shrugging his shoulders as though there's nothing he can do but wait for Dodd-Frank?
Well, again, there is something he can do. He can sign on to Elizabeth Warren's bill. He could also bring the which is a Glass-Steagall bill.
Right.
He could proceed with the congressional hearings on prosecuting those that caused this global economic meltdown. There's plenty that he can do. It is obvious to me that they are afraid of the of Wall Street.
Yeah, that's exactly what I think is what a lot of people think. And Bill, you talked to a lot of congressional offices these last 3 weeks. What is it about Wall Street that has them scared? I mean, obviously there's the contributions, the revolving door staffers, especially with the Finance Committee who come from Wall Street. But I think it's more than that. LaRouche has been talking about the fact that there's a corruption here, which is the corruption of money. Well, I'd like you to talk a little bit about that, Bill.
Yeah, well, it's so pervasive, the way in which these elected representatives in Washington, D.C., actually defer to the members of the Financial Services Committee. You know, you'll ask them, "Hey, where are you on Glass-Steagall? You know, are you ready to bankrupt Wall Street?" And they'll say, "Well, I have to talk to Scott Garrett about this," or Barney Frank, who, by the way, is no longer the Congress anymore, but he was the chair of the Financial Services Committee in the House. "I have to talk to Barney about this." And it's clear that what you've got is you've got a situation where the House Financial Services Committee is one of the biggest committees in the Congress, because it's a way of getting financial contributions for new, especially for new members in the Congress, for freshmen. They, if they, the, both parties deliberately appoint a lot of new members to the Financial Services Committee, and so you have people who campaigned on Glass-Steagall, or previously supported Glass-Steagall, who end up dragging their feet on it because they're getting a lot of money from Wall Street. And, you know, we've used this in meetings to just make the point very clear, sometimes asking them point blank, how much money is your boss getting from Wall Street, and how does that affect the fact that he hasn't signed on to Glass-Steagall yet? So it's, I mean, I think it's pretty obvious. It's pretty obvious that people have this mindset that if you want to have a career, you don't challenge, you know, you have company manners when it comes to discussing Wall Street.
Well, the other point is you can get all the money in the world from Wall Street, but you still have to get the votes from the voters. And Lamar, I'd like your thoughts on this question of, do these congressmen actually know how desperate the situation is, not just for handfuls of people, but, you know, we're now talking about over 80% of the jobs that are being created are part-time and low-wage. People are having a hard time paying rent, buying medicine, and buying food. Do you think in Washington there's an awareness of this, or do you think they're really that blind to what's happening back in their districts?
I don't think they really understand the cause and effect of the and I'm not trying to insult any of their intelligence. They're very intelligent people, but I don't think they really understand the cause and effect of the commingling of the commercial and investment banking, and how that directly affects the conditions back in that district, and what needs to be done to actually, first of all, put the wall up separating the two entities, and then secondly, to allow credit to be established for the reindustrialization and job creation. And their realities, unfortunate, is that I think many of them are more concerned about being reelected than doing the right thing. And since it costs an average of $2 million to be elected to Congress, and the only people who can afford to make those type of contributions to them are the people of in on Wall Street. And so basically, Wall Street has an army of congressmen who are bought and paid for, and their real constituents are Wall Street and not the people back home in their districts, if you really would want my generalized assessment.
Well, there's a famous poem by Percy Shelley called The Mask of Anarchy, where he has the famous line, "We are many, they are few." And even though there are few of them, I think part of the problem is that the people have not yet been heard from. Is that something that you would say is a fair assessment?
I would say that, in particular, the citizenry is either apathetic or they really don't grasp what's going on and what's happening to them. Uh-huh. And so we are many and they are few. They are rich and we are poor. they have the many dollars and we have the few dollars. And so it becomes what will prevail. Will the few with their dollars who they use those dollars to influence and misinform the public as to what their congressman is doing and what he can do and et cetera. So no one is, with exception of Mr. LaRouche, is really going out and saying, look, this is what needs to happen. Here's a plan, and this is what your congressman should be doing. And also at the same time, educating the masses. Because if you don't educate the masses, they'll respond like asses.
Well, you know, Lamar, you've been successful in running for office before, So you know that you can tell the truth and you can challenge people and get elected. I assume that would be your message to other elected officials, that they have to serve the people in their district, not the people of Wall Street.
Exactly. That would be the message. And then not be afraid of Mr. LaRouche. I mean, you're not going to agree 100% of the time with everybody. But if someone, if you look at it objectively, that's how I became I've worked with them, the LaRouche PAC, on many issues, whether it's the closing of hospitals in Washington, D.C., whether it's the retooling of the auto industry, whether it was the Glass-Steagall, issue by issue. Look at it, evaluate, and see if it is, and give it the smell test. See if it's real, and if it will cure. And don't be afraid of aligning with an organization that has your constituents and that benefits your constituents.
Now, Bill, this is a really useful point to make, because I know that what Lamar has just pointed out is the misinformation, the promotion of ignorance. You could also say the partisan politicking that Republicans have uniformly stayed away from Glass-Steagall. And it's Simon Johnson, the economist, who wrote an article the other day saying he doesn't get it. Why are the Republicans supporting what Geithner and Obama want when it comes to Glass-Steagall? Why don't the Democrats get the Republicans on board? But let me get to this deeper question of education. I want your thoughts on this, Bill. Lyndon LaRouche has been talking about the need to give people something more than Glass-Steagall as a legislative issue, that what it really represents is a constitutional principle when it comes to the question of physical economy. And this was what was the change in the organizing by the LaRouche PAC Policy Committee this last week. How did you approach people differently this last week in making clear that we're not just talking about, as you said, making the system more fair, but we're actually talking about replacing this Wall Street system with the American system? How did you do that in the organizing? And I'm asking you this because a lot of our listeners want to know how to go out and organize around this.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, there is a certain way, Harley, in which you can make an argument for Glass-Steagall, and on the basis of, you know, in a certain way, mathematics.
Right.
the if you take the eight largest banks in the United States, the so-called systemically important financial institutions internationally, their portfolio of derivatives surpasses many times, 10 times over, 20 times over, the gross domestic product of the entire planet. And so the simple point is the debt simply can't be paid. But that doesn't necessarily give you the intention,
right,
behind this. And the what's going on here is there's a conflict of intentions. There's a conflict of intention between Wall Street, which is an appendage of the British Empire, whose nominal head, the Queen of England, has stated her policy of bringing the world population to below 1 billion people through, you know, the power of the pen and other means, and the American Republic, which, and the American people, who require things like food and water and jobs, and so to be very direct and actually get right to the issue, that the key of Glass-Steagall is to bankrupt Wall Street, not as an action in and of itself, but actually to remove the criminal element from the government and from the controls of our financial system, in order to be able to organize a system in which the measure of value is not the monetary value on paper, but is actually what Alexander Hamilton successfully set up as a model for thinking about economics, which is that you've got to have a policy which increases the productive powers of your population, and that that is the only way of securing the defense of the population. And I actually recently have been looking at how John F. Kennedy did battle with Wall Street, and I think he was really the last president to understand the idea that even though our economy is in a certain sense a free economy, in the sense that businesses have the freedom to do business and make the choices that they want to, but they can't do that to the detriment of the general welfare of the nation. That the general welfare clause of the Constitution trumps everything else in the economy. And I have not seen a president who understood that principle since John F. Kennedy, since the Kennedy administration. And since he was assassinated, there has been a lack of that intention to have an economy which is based on an intention for what the country's got to look like in the future and the type of development that has to occur.
Look, that's very important. And Lamar, I'd like your thoughts on that from this standpoint. You brought up that some people are afraid to be associated with LaRouche, partly because they think that he says things that are too extreme. Well, one of the things he said is that there is a commitment on these Wall Street City of London bankers to reduce the population. And if you look at what's happening in a place like Detroit, or you look at California, or the budget-cutting mentality, they're taking away social services which are essential for the poor, the elderly, the sick, children of single-parent families. What else can you say but that is a policy of genocide?
I agree 100% that they're eliminating the life-giving and life-sustaining institutions as we talked earlier about the emergency, the EMS, we talked about the lack of the child mortality rate here in Detroit. They don't have as I pointed out to the staff of one senator that, you know, this is, you know, to put, what Bill just alluded to is that in the preamble, which sets up the premise for the basis of the Constitution, it says to provide for the general welfare, and they seem not to want to embrace the Constitution. But all of us who are elected have taken the oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States, and so these congressmen who staying away from Mr. LaRouche. And I said, look, when I called some offices, they said, well, you're with LaRouche. Why are you with LaRouche? Blah, 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 you know, because for my delegation and all they want. I said, look, I'm here to talk about the principle. Is the principles of Glass-Steagall, are they sound principles? I'm not dealing with the cult of personality. Just evaluate the principle. Now, the principles of reindustrialization and job creation, are they sound or not? Irrespective of who's saying it, or whether you like or agree with something else they said once upon a time. And so that was one of the things that I encountered while in Washington.
Now, on that note, Bill, we're coming to, we have about 10 minutes left of the program, and I want to take up the other thing that Lynn has been addressing, which is that, you know, the solution for Detroit is not going to come from Detroit, that people have been beaten down. As Lamar pointed out, a lot of the people there are elderly, that they have to find protectors and defenders from the rest of the country, which is going in that direction. So how do you, when you were talking before, Bill, about this question of realizing the general welfare through technological advance, through a credit policy, how do you give hope to people so that they can stand up and fight against what seems to be overwhelming odds, the power of the oligarchy?
Well, here's the sense that's got to be communicated to those people, is that the destruction of the city of Detroit and the attack on that population that's happening with the attack on the pension funds, this has been an attack on the entire nation. And you know, when people realize the that this has been an attack on the entire nation, they can realize that that the nation can be mobilized to defend everyone. And you know, in fact, also the issue with Detroit, you know, because there is a lot there's a way in which people get divided and get sucked into some sort of belief that Detroit's troubles are because of Detroit. But when you remind people that what Detroit was and has been is the arsenal of democracy, is the is represented by the machine tool capacity of the country, then the whole fate of the nation depends on Detroit and depends on this area of the so-called Rust Belt, which has got to be revived. And, you know, what I think, and when I mean it has to be revived, I mean if the population of the United States is going to survive. Because you look at California, you look at places like Texas, the food supply is being collapsed. The dairy cattle business in California, the beef cattle, the chicken and hog industries are really very rapidly collapsing in Iowa and in these different places. And the ability to actually build up a new platform of ability in this country to control weather, to control flood and water distribution, such as with the North American Water and Power Alliance, this is actually going to depend on an increased manufacturing base for the nation. That is, if we're going to take this plan from 1964 that Kennedy supported and Robert Kennedy campaigned on, which is to transfer 130 million acre-feet of water per year from the northwest part of the continent down into the western states to alleviate these dry conditions, we're going to need massive amounts of equipment, and we cannot gear up the manufacturing base in order to do that without nuclear power. And I think that there exists a capability for Detroit to become the center of a production operation for assemblies of nuclear power plants, and as an example. And so the whole fate of the country rests, and if we can communicate this, communicate that the country's got to stand together and fight for not only Glass-Steagall, but the organization of our economy on the basis of Hamilton's system of public credit to make possible the public credit for building up these industrial capabilities. That's the only way the country is going to have a future if we're not going to starve to death under this collapsed food state that's been brought about.
Well, Bill, the point that you made that really is an important one, this question of unifying the nation. You know, you have people who still have jobs, who have 401k plans, and their 401k plans seem to be going up in value because of the stock market bubble. And they are feeling very smug, and they also feel a little threatened by the idea that they may be asked to do something for Detroit. We're not asking them to bail out Detroit, but I would say to them, they ought to take a look at what's in their 401k plans. They may have Detroit City bonds in there. They have a lot of worthless paper that shows up as value in their portfolio. But if they had to cash it in, there would be nothing there. And so these smug people who buy the lines of Republicans and Fox News and others that we people who are doing well shouldn't be asked to take care of the people who aren't doing well, they're living in a fool's paradise. Now, the flip side of that is what you said, that we can reverse this. And Lamar, I'd like to ask you, if you see in your organizing and your activity, not with the Congress, but with your constituents, the people who elected you to the state legislature and to the Board of Education, if you see a possibility that they can be rallied by this idea of the hope that we can restore economic justice in our republic?
Most definitely, especially when you lay out a plan and bring the discussion to the fore, and then let it sink or swim on its merits, as I've always done with Mr. LaRouche and the LaRouche Pack. Look at the ideas, debate the ideas, investigate the ideas, but you have to really make it as simplistic as possible and bring it to the public. And people realize that jobs have to be created, and we have to, and they just want to know how to do it, how it can be done. And Mr. LaRouche has laid out a plan that, like I've seen no one else lay out a plan, a step-by-step plan.
And that's where you can reinstill hope in people, including the elderly and the young.
Exactly.
Now, Bill, we have the Congress did recess without Glass-Steagall, and a lot of our listeners are wondering what this means. I mean, Lynn said last night that the danger of war is always here when Congress is out of session, when you have August, where people head to the beaches and their man caves and hidey holes and try and get away from reality. That's when you really do have a danger of war. But it's also the case that a lot of these congressmen are going to be back in their districts now. What should people do over the month of August to ramp up the potential to get Glass-Steagall voted in as soon as they return?
They need to contact their congressmen, both their senators and the members and their reps, and push. Let them know, and what needs to happen is a massive mobilization of individuals who demand Glass-Steagall from these. And so if the public can say, look, it's Glass-Steagall or you will not be elected, we don't care how much money Wall Street gives you to convince us. See, that's what Wall Street does. They give money to these elected officials that they've bought, and that money is used to convince you that their congressman is doing a good job and in their interest. And so without a organization like LaRouche Pack, which will inform them of what their congressman has stood for, what they've turned down, what they've been presented with as alternatives, even if they didn't grasp it, and what they've chosen. And when the public looks at the two and they do an objective evaluation, they will either demand these policies be implemented, Glass-Steagall, reindustrialization, et cetera, or from their congressman, or they will turn their congressman out and put someone who will truly represent their interests.
And, Bill, I'll give you the last word on this. What's the policy committee going to be up to in the next weeks?
Well, you know, this is a period in which I think the Congress is going to be, in a certain sense, showing their face a lot, campaigning. You know, it's a period in which they're going to be going out into the public and asking the public for their support once again in the next phase of elections. And, you know, we just saw in the last few weeks from the activities of the policy committee in D.C., there were some meager gains in new co-signers. But if you look at one of the co-signers on the H.R. 129 bill was Rush Holt from New Jersey, who is one of the four Democratic candidates campaigning for the New Jersey Senate seat. And this was a situation in which he distinguished himself, realizing that there is a certain lobby within actually the population for Glass-Steagall. We've seen this in a number of campaigns for U.S. Senate in particular, where one candidate actually distinguishes themselves by saying, I'm not the Wall Street guy, I'm for Glass-Steagall.
That was Ed Markey, who just got elected in Massachusetts, is one of the new signers on the Senate bill.
Exactly. So we do actually have, there is a certain power that we have as the American population to say, look, you represent us. That means you've got to represent our interests, and we are not going to survive much longer if Congress does not move to put back in place Glass-Steagall. So we're not begging them. We're telling them what to do. And the policy committee is going to be leading a fight in the districts to amplify what we've been doing in these recent weeks of getting groups, different public officials, various groups like the National Farmers Organization and other organizations to realize that they've got to come together and unify around this breakthrough that needs to be made now to shut down Wall Street. And that's got to be done, as Mr. LaRouche made the point, very soon, because if we're still in this condition by Thanksgiving, then you might be the turkey on the table.
Well, we'll have to end with that turkey reference, Bill. Lamar, it's great talking to you again, and glad to know that you were putting the fight in Washington. We'll talk with you again soon. And, Bill, thank you. And this has been another edition of The LaRouche Show. We will be back with you next Saturday, 3 p.m. Eastern. And you can get your friends to listen to this because it will be archived on LaRouchePub.com under The LaRouche Show. Thanks, and talk to you next week.